the late Richard M. Nixon. He's back.
We better forget about the goddamn campaign right this minute. Not tomorrow. Now, that's what concerns me. We've got all this power, we're not using it. Now, what the Christ is the matter? In other words, what I'm really saying is this. I think we have to get it out.
I don't know.
Well, you've got the facts. Did you check the other side of the facts? What is going on with that? Who is working on this full time? That's what I want to know. Who's running IRS? Who's running over the Justice Department? So, what I meant is, with all the agencies of government, what in the name of God are we doing about the McGovern contributors?
Well, the short answer to your question is nothing.
Well, they're doing it to us.
No question, no question.
It never happened that way before. Johnson screwed everybody. Kennedy. When we went out in 52, the Truman people were kicking the hell out of me.
Sure.
62. They kicked the hell out of me. Part of the problem is the bureaucracy. But part of the problem is our own goddamn fault. There's got to be something we can do.
I don't disagree.
Is there anybody who can do this kind of work? The trouble is, of course, we have too many nice guys around who just want to do the right thing.
Too many nice guys. Yes, that was Nixon's problem. What you're listening to is not National Archive tape, but its authenticity comes from the detailed sensitivity and, dare I say, reverence for Richard Nixon and the time and the characters of the Watergate era and before and after, from comedian Harry Shear, who's released a 6-part series on YouTube called Nixon's The One. Harry Shear joins us now. Harry, this is remarkable stuff here. It gives me chills and goosebumps. It must have been a lot of fun going back into history like this.
Yeah, I don't regard it as history because, to me, Nixon's always been around. Even after he died on my radio show, I started doing a series of sketches based on 3 improbable premises. 1, that there's a place called heaven. 2, that Nixon got in. And 3, that he's still taping. So, yeah, he's such a central character to the American 20th century to me. He's a self-made man and a self-destroyed man. So he wrote his own punchline. But he gave us this incredible gift. Willy-nilly, he recorded almost every waking word of his for 5.5 years. And so I decided to, with my writing partner, Stanley Cutler, who's a world-renowned historian on the tapes, to focus on these conversations that are not about Watergate, they're not about Vietnam, this is not about history or politics. This is conversations revealing of the character, the incredibly complex, twisted, resentful, paranoid character of this guy.
Well, here's a realization of a scene that followed a news conference on the 16th of April in 1971.
I must say, I was tremendously impressed with the delicacy with which you handled those foreign policy questions, because this was a tough moment.
Well, the main thing was not to give anything. I mean, we didn't give any the goddamn thing away.
Not a thing.
I didn't give a thing about, frankly, Henry, I didn't give a thing away about Vietnam. Mm. Didn't give a thing away about China. I said, I'm not going to talk about that.
Beautiful.
I said, this is not the time to talk about
it. That was beautiful.
Now, the way the China thing sits now, we haven't said anything. And the way that...
It doesn't raise any expectations.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, most of the expectations have been raised.
And that I said, in effect, insofar as we're concerned, we're ready to trade, we're ready to exchange.
Excellent.
But in terms of recognition or the technical problems or these other problems, I ain't going to talk about it. I thought that was good.
What is that, Berlioz playing in the background? He sounds like a 19th century, I don't know, European leader with megalomaniac I don't know what.
This was late in the evening. He actually was listening to music as Kissinger started the conversation. And he was, as you could tell, a little bit in his cups at that point. That was an interesting challenge, was to play that Nixon, the Nixon who had been spending a bit of the evening with his friend, the bottle. But this is one of a series of incidents where Kissinger is just being as obsequious as humanly possible. You know, he knew that Nixon didn't like two of Kissinger's primary characteristics. He was Jewish and he was a professor at Harvard, 2 things Nixon loathed. And Kissinger was aware of this, but he needed Nixon. He needed Nixon to have access to power that Kissinger craved. So this relationship, we devote an entire episode of the series to this very, very strange tortured relationship between these two very smart people who were using each other, or thought they were using each other.
You know, and it seems so not American. It really seems like some scene from the Louis the 16th.
From the court, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we know that people in power surround themselves with sycophants, but we've never heard it before. And this is the way it sounds.
Very interesting thing. So few of those who engage in espionage are Negroes. Very lucky that way. As a matter of fact, very few of them become communists. But the Negroes, if you were nuts enough to plant Negro spies.
Oh, well, they're not as intellectual, though. They're not smart enough.
It may be.
They're not smart enough to be spies.
But
they're not as intellectual.
The Jews are barn spies. Do you know something I've learned? They're just in it up to their necks.
Well, the basic devious symbol is deviousness.
I know. Also an arrogance. An arrogance that, that's what makes a spy, you know? He puts himself above the law.
Wow, no. That's just so astounding. He's such an authority on this. That's what's really chilling.
Well, he speaks with this mien of authority about all these people that he dislikes, and it's very strange. But also, of course, the irony in the light of later developments that he's talking about other people as thinking of themselves above the law.
I love this scene with Billy Graham, who was a very trusted advisor. I mean, there was constant talk about his access to the Oval Office and Nixon soliciting advice from him. But when you hear what it is they actually talked about, church doesn't come to mind here. Listen.
The real question is whether this country is going to believe anything. Now, we all have different degrees of religions and different ways of expressing, but among the professors and the associate professors in the colleges and universities and the junior colleges and high schools, I think 90% of them are atheists or worse. They have no confidence in themselves. They have no faith in this country.
Well, they're undermining the country.
And they're communists.
Harry, is he talking about, I don't know, martial law here in the universities?
No. You know, he's standing as the savior and the protector of what he regarded as traditional American values. We've heard this, of course, from others before and since. Billy Graham wasn't just sitting in on all these conversations with Nixon. He had insinuated himself in the White House back in the days of Eisenhower. And you have to wonder, what was it about this set of relationships that attracted him so much? He apparently just liked to render unto Caesar. But, he's sitting there, and he and Nixon talk about the media and about the Jews and about all of this stuff.
I think that the really scary thing is that the media control used to be, in certain places, the writers on television have always been Jewish. Yep. Jack Benny's writers and all those people, they always have been. But now, what's become the old-time press corps? The old-time White House press corps wasn't Jewish.
Yep.
But you look at what covers the president today, and it's really kind of scary.
In some way, these conversations are so remarkable because you have to keep in mind the meter is running on this. This is while we're paying him to be president of the United States.
Right.
And they're just having what sound like really demented college late-night bull sessions.
How did you deal with the sort of demands that this be done authentically, low res? You've got to get the off mic quality, you can't make it cinematic, really. It's got to be found stuff that you have.
Yes,
on
exactly
YouTube.
Right. Yeah. It was my decision at the beginning that we had cameras hidden so that the sense was that Nixon had not just hidden microphones in the White House, but he'd hidden cameras in the Oval Office as well. So it was shot from these weird angles with plants in the way and stuff like that. And then we shot it in pristine high-definition video and then degraded it to try to make it look like it was found video from the 1970s. And there was a bit – this originally aired on the Sky Network in the UK. It was made for them. And there was an argument at the end because they, after having liked it, they wanted it to look like HD. And the last thing in the world I wanted this to look like was historic recreation theater, you know. I wanted it to look real. I wanted it to look like if you stumbled across it, oh, my God, where did these come from? That's one of the reasons I love the English crew that I was working with. They got every detail of Nixon's Oval Office right. They even managed to find the guy in England who owned two copies of the actual camera that CBS News used to shoot the television coverage of his resignation speech and brought that guy down to London. And
wow.
He operates one of the cameras. I mean,
and that scene,
you know,
is
it's a 360 degree Oval Office set. When the actors walked in, there was no place to look where they weren't in Nixon's world. And the whole feeling that I wanted to accomplish with the show is this very claustrophobic feeling of you're trapped in this guy's world and you can't get out for 30 minutes. And that's what it is.
Do you feel like you know him better, Nixon, from all this?
A little bit. I mean, there's this famous scene. It had been videotaped and traded around for years of the 8 minutes before he delivers his resignation speech, which always just struck me as goofy. And he's about to undergo the live humiliation on national TV of resigning. And what does he do when he walks into the Oval Office? He starts cracking jokes with the crew.
Hey, you're better looking than I am. Why don't you stay here? Blondes, they say, photograph better than brunette. Is that true or not?
I don't know, sir.
Or you. You are blonde, aren't you?
No, sir.
Redhead?
No, thinning.
We're the same.
And I always thought this was goofy. And as we were rehearsing it, I did have an epiphany. I realized what was going on. To avoid being in the moment of maximum humiliation, he was already plotting his next campaign, his campaign for rehabilitation. The guys on the crew were going to walk out that night and say to their friends and family, well, he wasn't depressed. He wasn't upset. He wasn't mad. He was a nice guy. He was cracking jokes. The
wow.
next campaign was beginning.
That's amazing. Comedian Harry Shearer is the voice behind Richard Nixon in the new 6-part series on YouTube called Nixon's the One. Harry Shearer, thank you.
Thank you, John.
You know, this has been an absolute eye-opener for me.
Quite an eye-opener, this thing.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.